Hello, and welcome to the Ace Pod episode 3.7, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. We are back after our holiday siesta of sorts, I guess. It was nice to have a little bit of time off of podcasting, although I did not take very much of a break from writing. It's good to be back on the bike. Connor, how was your holiday, man?
It was good and blissfully free of Michigan football.
That is possibly the most important thing. Dan, Happy New Year. How you doing, man?
Happy New Year, Ace. Same as Connor. I mean, like, it was, I think every holiday that I've gone home for the past, like, you know, since I've been in college, and then, you know, in the real world, has either been, you know, Thanksgiving, which, like, obviously always Ohio State game, and then bowl game for Christmas, you know, at some point, and those have gone, you know, about as well as the Ohio State game, except for, like, one time. Blissfully free of Michigan football.
Well, the holiday season may have been free of Michigan football, but it was not free at all from Michigan football rumors, and they are still going on. We are recording this on Tuesday night, starting at around 7 p.m. I feel the need to note the time just in case something happens before we get this actually published, because I don't know what the heck's going on. It doesn't seem like anybody really knows what the heck's going on. It does sound like there's an offer on the table. There's some rumors flying out there that Harbaugh might sign it. There are also some rumors that Harbaugh is maybe talking to the Jets. So, like, I don't know what to make of everything. It does feel like things are going to happen on a relatively shortish timeline now that Black Monday is past us in the NFL, but it does very much feel like things are maybe more uncertain, at least in terms of the word coming out from Michigan people, than they have been before, at least in terms of odds people are willing to put on Harbaugh coming back. Is that the sense that you guys get? And just, I don't know, what level of optimism do you feel as members of the, you know, avowed soup gang members? Dan, I'll start with you, man.
It feels like we've been getting the same line from the, I guess, Michigan insider side of things, that, like, hey, there's a deal on the table. He's told everyone, whether that be recruits or coaches or whatever other contacts, that he intends to be the, you know, be coaching next year. But I mean, I don't know. It's, I guess, from, you know, to not be just totally credulous, like, I don't know what else he would tell recruits or coaches. So I just don't. I mean, like, I don't think it's necessarily, like, a sign that he's leaving, but I also don't know how much credence I put in it. And then, you know, you have, like, a couple of rumors that he's interested in, you know, seeing, in at least exploring NFL options. And I have to imagine those are correct, because I just don't think that if he really wasn't interested at all in the NFL, I think he would have signed it by now. And I think that if his intention was to, you know, definitely be Michigan's coach next year, I think that, you know, like, there's been an offer and there's been probably a counter offer from Harbaugh. And then there's probably even been a third, you know, a second offer from the AD. So, like, you know, whatever the deal is right now is probably, like, the final deal on the table. And if Harbaugh was 1,000% coming back, then I think that he would have signed it, to be quite frank. So, yeah, I don't, but all that said, it's like, I don't know. I mean, you know, by the time we finish this podcast, he could have signed and it could have just been, like, a, you know, small, like, you know, whatever clause at the end of it that they were fighting over, who knows. But I don't know. That's my rambling and completely, you know, non-committal take.
Yeah, well, I think in that ramble, you did a good job covering all the bases. I think the key point here is that it seems pretty clear there's been an offer on the table for weeks now. And obviously, those weeks coincide with the holiday. They coincide with Jim Harbaugh going on vacation. You know, well earned. Did a great job this year. Deserved to take 2 weeks off for sure. And I guess all I have to say is, Jim Harbaugh right now, I believe that wherever he coaches next year, whether it's Michigan or not, he wants to win football games. He's a competitive guy, regardless of what other critiques we have of him. And right now, he's not acting like a guy who is doing everything he can and throwing himself into getting Michigan ready to win football games next year, which suggests that there is still a great deal of distance between, you know, this idea of extending him and where he's at. And you kind of get the vibes as your vibes analyst. I'm going to say the vibe right now, based on the limited info that everybody has, the vibe is that both parties want an amicable exit without a buyout, without a firing.
I really need to start introducing you that way, by the way, vibes analyst. I'm dropping the ball there. I'm trying to couch my optimism because optimism has only resulted in pain when it comes to Michigan football of late. But at the same time, it does feel like with each passing day, it becomes more likely that you have that amicable parting of the ways. Hopefully the issue is not merely one of, is there enough NFL interest? I have to think that there's at least one or two teams out there that'll at least put a feeler out, give him a phone call, gauge his interest. And you have to imagine right now that if interest is put out to him, that he's definitely reciprocated it. It's hard to imagine what else would be holding up the whole process because, Connor, as you said, I mean, if Harbaugh was going entirely for just let's win football games at Michigan this upcoming season, he'd have a contract signed because, you know, from everything we've seen rumor-wise, there's one out there. And he'd have the contract signed. He'd be going after grad transfer defensive tackle targets, hold that thought for a little while. And he'd be, you know, starting to really plan for next season. I'm not sure he'd be taking a quote-unquote vacation in California or whatever the hell that was. Before we ramble on any further, we did take mailbag questions for this one, and I am jamming them into different segments in terms of their relevance. So we should get to a few of these because they are directed towards the coaching search and Harbaugh specifically. First one is from at WPM in STL. What leverage does Harbaugh have over the athletic department that he can seemingly use Michigan as a backup plan and bargaining chip while an offer just remains on the table for him to accept or reject at his leisure? A pointed question. Connor, let's start with you.
I am going to go with the obvious kind of non-sentimental answer, which is that one gets the sense, and I've ranted about institutional arrogance before, and I'm not sure this falls into that purview, but one gets the sense that Michigan is particularly reluctant to pay out a large sum of money for firing a coach during a pandemic year. I don't know what orders have been handed down on high about that, but given everything we know about this administration at Michigan, it wouldn't surprise me if Schlissel and his buddies were real hardliners about trying to avoid that. I think that by itself, the prospect of a huge, I think it's $16 million, right? A huge buyout during this pandemic ravaged year is pretty significant and is reason enough to pursue a potential amicable parting. I think there's some good reasoning there, even if it's frustrating for us to watch.
Yeah, I think that's getting to have your cake and eat it too, right? I mean, like, I think from Ward's perspective, why wouldn't you, and look, again, I've said this a million times, like, I'm not saying like, oh, Ward's definitely got this, you know, he's on top of it. He's thinking the exact same thing I am. But I think if you wanted to get rid of Harbaugh, like, why not wait, you know, to Black Monday, right? I mean, you could get him off your hands for nothing. And you wouldn't have to, and you'd have that much more money to spend on a new coach or, you know, to just more realistically probably inflate whatever administrative budgets there are or salaries there are. But I mean, yeah, I think also part of it, you know, Connor said he'd be non-sentimental. I'll be a little bit sentimental. I think that they sort of don't want it to seem like they're firing, you know, an alum, you know, like we've talked about, like I think I talked about before. I think that they don't necessarily want to be seen to, you know, fire someone who was, you know, a great, has been a pretty good, like, ambassador for Michigan, whether or not, you know, that means actually winning football games. I think he's, you know, handled himself pretty well and represented Michigan relatively positively. And also, you know, is an alum and literally played football with Ward. So, you know, and I think that probably letting him put out feelers to the NFL also makes it, you know, makes Michigan the more sentimental figure here in terms of like, hey, like, you know, what do you want us to do? Like, he was clearly looking for the NFL. I don't know. That's a couple different answers. But I don't think, like, really to answer the question, I don't think that Harbaugh has any leverage per se. I think that Ward, if he really wanted to fire Harbaugh and was dead set on it, could do it without any, you know, any real blowback.
Yeah, it seems like any leverage here is really more leverage that Michigan is allowing Harbaugh to have than leverage that Harbaugh actually controls, if that makes sense. And it certainly seems like if Ward Manuel wanted to just pull the trigger on a firing and had the permission to do so from, you know, the board of trustees and the president, which, you know, those guys definitely play into a decision once you start throwing around, you know, well over $10 million in buyout money. It definitely, you know, there's a lot that makes sense, both, you know, for optics and just practically waiting. I mean, Matt Campbell's season ended, what, 4 days ago? You know, it's not like we've been in a holding pattern for that long once the things that we kind of had to wait on to start moving have actually started moving. Black Monday was yesterday, as we said. So there's still, you know, it feels like things have taken forever, but we keep talking about how this was, you know, probably going to be a pretty painful, drawn-out process, even if it was going the right way. So, yeah, it's painful and drawn out. We'll see how it goes. It might end quickly now, and that might be a good thing. It might be a bad thing. And a lot of that also depends on how you feel about things. Our second mailbag question, if Harbaugh is extended, what do you think Michigan will need to do over the next year or two for him to get off the hot seat? That is from Tuba1080. Dan, I have a feeling you have strong thoughts on this one.
So I think my worst nightmare for Michigan football is that, you know, we'll extend Harbaugh, give him, you know, this kind of prove it year, and he's going to like kind of prove it and go like, you know, 9-4. And then it's like, what, are we going to fire him? Like, you know, let's say like he beats Michigan State, loses to Ohio State like by 10 or 15 or something. You know, Ohio State might be a little bit down next year. And then has like one other loss on the schedule and then, you know, loses a bowl game as is tradition. Like, are we going to fire him? Like, what is, you know, like what changes from this year to next that would, you know, make this, make this administration want him gone for sure? I think that if he, to get off the hot seat, I think that he'd have to win at least 9 games, probably 10. But I mean, then again, it's like we've had the Harbaugh hot seat conversation every year since probably 2017. So like in reality, like is anything short of beating Ohio State really going to get Harbaugh off the, you know, proverbial hot seat? I don't know. I guess in the next year or two, I would say like he absolutely needs to beat Ohio State in the next 2 years to really get off the hot seat.
God, all of this really just sounds like the Gus Malzahn zone, or the Gus Malzahn, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think so. Beating Ohio State is like an instant trip off the hot seat. That is obvious. I would not couch it in terms of record for Harbaugh. I would say it honestly is a vibes thing. This is where my rule comes into play. I think if we're looking at Michigan's roster, which has some issues but has a lot of talent on it, and we see an on-field product where maybe you don't beat Ohio State, maybe you do go 9-4 and lose the traditional bowl game, whatever, and it's more of like an acceptable rather than a great season. I think if we feel like the talent is being maximized to a great extent, the arrows are up in terms of the coaching staff, in terms of recruiting, in terms of player development, and we feel like we're on track to the kind of feel that Michigan had in like 2016, right? Which was, you know, a better team than what you're going to have next year, but like the arrows were all up. And the vibe around the program from the coach on down was extremely energetic and swaggering and ambitious. I think you want to get back to that place. Whether you win 8 games or 10 games is less important than just like, do we feel like all these things are trending in the right direction in a pretty decisive way?
Yeah, I agree that you don't necessarily want to put a hard number on it just because that tends to arbitrarily limit you in the way you can make decisions in a smart way. But I think you have to at least give Ohio State a scare. Like, because that's really like, you got to get a conference title at some point before we all die. And, you know, that's the main obstacle right now. And while Ohio State has been on an arrow straight up, it can't stay that way forever. So you got to start at least chipping into the gap and show some progress in that regard. And you can probably tell by how I'm talking about it that I'm not super optimistic that he can do it. But I think what it would take.
I would take just like a good offense. Like, I don't know, just like maybe just one or two things we haven't seen from Harbaugh before. Like just competence on offense and in end of game situations and like some sense of urgency in 2-minute drills. Like, I don't know. Like these are it's just so bleak talking about what we would really need to see from him.
Yeah, just to add to it, he would definitely have to nail these coaching hires because you would have to have a certain level of cohesiveness and promise from this coaching staff that you know that you're not going to have to go through any more like large-scale staff changes. Because if that happens for any reason other than this guy was so good that he got hired away, then I think that has to be it for Harbaugh with just how many chances he's had to reset his staff. Our last question before we move on to more general football things. How much of your desire to move on from Harbaugh is driven by what any fan can observe, on-field play, recruiting, etc., versus insider info the typical fan can't observe, like rapport with team, interactions with high school coaches, etc.? That is from at Doug, though, and then a whole long string of numbers that I'm not going to read. I guess I'll probably start with this one. I have been certainly privy to some insider info that I think tips me more towards the desire to move on. I'm not going to say that hasn't played a factor. At the same time, I think most of what I feel about that is something that you could easily glean from just following Michigan football at a relatively close level. You know, a lot of it has to do with just, you know, a certain level of disorganization in the coaching staff. And I mean, there's been a whole lot of turnover there that I don't think that's exactly a state secret. And I mean, we'll see if he wants to move on as well, but I just also think the timing is right. I am not privy to, you know, his like interactions with the team. I don't talk to high school coaches, you know, I'm not on the recruiting beat. I don't claim to be an insider. So this is not like a true insider take. I just, you know, occasionally, you know, stumble into some info or get stuff passed along to me. And I think it does move the needle for me a little bit in the direction of wanting to move on from Harbaugh. Do either of you guys want to add to that at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think I do get getting some people that know things, you know, feeding me stuff. I don't get as much as Ace or the core MGo blog guys. And I'm not an insider, obviously. But like, the reality is Michigan is like an irritatingly tight ship as a program. Not that much juicy stuff leaks out, certainly in a timely manner, from what I can tell. And I hear that a lot from like beat reporters who do this full time. And most of the stuff that I've heard that wouldn't necessarily make it into public immediately is stuff that I wouldn't care about if Michigan were beating Ohio State. it's stuff where it's like, yeah, can Harbaugh be like prickly or difficult to a certain extent? That's been said about him his entire coaching career, I assume back
life.
Going back to entire life, back when he was a player. Yeah, and no one would care. I mean, Nick Saban's probably pretty prickly, right? If Harbaugh were winning 12 games in the regular season, I would just find it all endearing and wonderful. So it really does come down to that we haven't beaten Ohio State, and in year six, we're here.
Yeah, I actually kind of think I have a little bit of a more interesting, like, not more interesting perspective, not to trash you guys. That's not what I meant to say.
Just crapping on Connor's take real quick.
Sorry, boring guys. I have a little bit of a different perspective on this because, you know, I was – My freshman year at Michigan was Brady Hoke's last year. So, like, I was here for 16-17, 16-17-18.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And then, 15-16-17. And then also I did an extra year, so I was here for 18 too. So, anyway,
Brady Hoke's last year was 2014, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so I was here 15-16-17.
Oh, yeah.
And then so there you go. Fifth year, super senior. But the point being that, you know, not that I was like friends with any of the football players, but I certainly like, you know, had enough classes with one or two of them that like you get an idea of like what the team is like. And even when they were like, you know, on that really like fun run in 2015 and then also like, you know, really good in 2016, like I always was hearing stuff like, oh, you know, Jim Harbaugh, like Harbaugh's just, you know, such a hardo, like it's like practices are no fun, like blah blah blah. And it's like that's stuff that like I totally brushed off at the time because it's like, one, they were winning, but two, I've been on a football, like I played football in high school, and I know that like everyone bitches about the coach. That's just what you do if you're on a football team. So like that kind of stuff like never really bothered me. I think what does sort of bother me is just the volume of transfers they've had and the volume of coaches that have left the program. And I don't have any insider info on this. You know, I know what is on the 24/7 boards and all that. But ultimately, I think that like there is a trend on this program of people not wanting to be around Jim Harbaugh. And I think, you know, Brian wrote about this a while ago in like his sort of postmortem of the season, I guess, is that it does really genuinely feel like there's something about Jim Harbaugh that rubs players and coaches the wrong way. And I think it's definitely materially hurt Michigan. But that, all that said, like, again, the vast majority of the reason that I want Harbaugh gone is the stuff that we see on the field every week. It's just, you know, the general disorganization and, you know, failure to adapt and blah, 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 blah.
All right, after the break, we are going to keep doing more of this. When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
Acknowledge past lives. Statements will be made. Acknowledge me. Acknowledge me. My mind is heaven's gate, so enter me.
Enter me.
My mind's the gate to hell, so try to flee.
Try to flee.
Both gates look the same, which will it be? Demons scream from thought process. Enter semen, childborn stress. Body want to sleep, but the mind can't rest. Measure pleasure through financial progress. When it comes to currency, love is non-existent. foes mock to fight. Friends become so distant. Some hope you die backstabbed in an instant. Foes I despise, disguise as allies to sabotage, camouflage. Loyalty is lies. To see God, look into my eyes. To see the devil, then you look into my eyes. I'ma slow it up, speed it up, slow it up, speed it up. Metal fingers, feet, beats, grim reaper, eat 'em up. Speed 'em up, slow 'em up, speed it up, slow it up. Brain sick, tick, 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 MF, blow it up. Slow it up, speed it up, slow it up, speed it up. Metal fingers, feet, beats, grim reaper, eat it up. Speed it up, slow it up, speed it up, slow it up. Brain sick, tick, 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 MF, blow it up, take air. Press it, bless it, Lynch loops like
clues. All right, our next one comes from at Leftist Luten. Would you want Campbell to bring his whole staff from ISU? Campbell, of course, being Matt Soup Campbell, as the object of all of our affection for several weeks now. Would you want Campbell to bring his whole staff from ISU, just the coordinators, and surround them with elite recruiters, a few of his guys, but force them to get big-name coordinators? What would be major personnel differences in the transition? ISU does a lot of 12 and 13 personnel. Is that just a reflection of the talent they could get at Iowa State, or is that a strategic preference for his staff offensively? Would the 404 tight defense, or whatever it's called, mitigate our DT issues? That's a lot of questions all in one. While I try to digest all that, I'm going to throw it to Connor.
Yeah, so I don't have like quite as in-depth X's and O's takes on the bringing the Iowa State staff in. I will say,
yeah, by no means feel the need to answer all of those.
Well, I just wanted to throw out there that one of my like smartest football knower friends, who does his own like charting of Clemson football, which is a pretty good case study for good defenses, he thinks that the 404 tight stuff that Iowa State does is the future of NFL defenses. And so, like, I say by all means bring that to Michigan. I mean, it's given Oklahoma fits, which is a pretty good like starting point for trying to beat Ohio State. So that's good. But for me, I think if Campbell came in, I would want to see coordinators because those guys have had success. And then I think there's a bunch of guys on Michigan staff that you would be smart to try to keep. I mean, I don't know how traditional this is in coaching transitions, but I think it would be silly to kick people like Sharon Moore and Ed Warner to the curb because they're about as good at what they do as you're going to get. And some continuity there would be good. And also Michigan needs more recruiters in general, and the kind of guys you've got on staff as recruiters at Michigan are going to be of a higher caliber, frankly, than you can get at Iowa State. So, yeah, I think the key there would be to bring in definitely Heacock, who's a really good DC. Off the top of my head, I forget who the offensive coordinator is, which maybe whatever. But the point being, like, yeah, I think you need to look at this as we're going to have the caliber of staff that Michigan should have, not just import an Iowa State staff.
Tom Manning, by the way, is Iowa State's offensive.
I'm sure he's great.
He's been with Campbell since the Toledo days, so those guys have at least been tied at the hip for quite a while. Dan, did you have thoughts on adding to this bevy of questions with some answers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're getting with Campbell is a guy that's a program builder, and you know, not just a CEO, head coach. Like a guy that takes like a really active role in every part of like preparation. At least that's just what it seems like from the outside. So really, to just be totally short on this, I think that if we ended up getting Campbell, I would sort of just trust him to do whatever he wanted. And I think that, you know, I mean, look, you can't just give people blank checks because that's kind of how you ended up with like the defensive tackle situation and, you know, the general roster disorder under Harbaugh. But I would say, like, look, if he wants to bring his defensive coordinator along, and they try the 404 tight, and it, you know, and it ends up working, you know, like I'm happy with that. I would say the only thing I would be looking for is for Matt Campbell to understand that he does have more resources and more like gravitas at Michigan than at Iowa State, and use that how he see fits. You know, whether that's upgrading a couple position coaches or going to a different defense that maybe like utilizes the talent you can get more, or like whatever he decides that is, or maybe, you know, modifying his offense, whatever that is. I would just want him to say, like, okay, Michigan's a different program than Iowa State, and adjust accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Campbell is adept enough to make those adjustments. It's not like he's been running all of the same stuff from Toledo all the way through Iowa State. He's adapted to be able to defend Big 12 offenses and done so quite successfully. And I think, you know, one of the maybe the lesson that we learned from the Rich Rodriguez tenure at Michigan was that you can't kind of tell a football coach how to run their team. You've got to, at least within, you know, reasonable parameters, let them make decisions about their staff, let them run the stuff that they're comfortable running. And if they're not good at it, then move on. But, you know, say not paying up to bring a guy's defensive coordinator along and then later asking a different defensive coordinator to run that guy's defense is something you don't want to see happen. But I agree in general with Connor in terms of the structure you want to see in terms of, you know, if he wants to bring his coordinators along, do it, especially Heacock.
Yeah, we better get Heacock if we get Campbell. That's
yeah,
that's
I want him whether or not they get Campbell. So, yeah. And I think he's probably my leading choice for DC of the names that have been plausibly or remotely plausibly thrown out there so far.
I have something in high school. My high school defense actually ran the 3-3-5, and we were awful like my first couple years. And I walked in on my like head coach one day, like reading this like article or whatever that was like 50 stunts from the 3-3-5. And I don't know, it made me think of Greg Robinson, and like that's probably what he was doing when he was like forced to run the 3-3-5 for Rich Rod
on the 3-3-5 page of the Football for Dummies book.
Yeah,
man.
I was like, oh, the three is for linebackers. Interesting.
This is bleak. All right, I'm going to move on to the next question before I get real sad. Why do we have so little insight? But actually, I need to preface this question by saying I'm pretty sure he means student athletes here, because otherwise this question is much more difficult to answer. Why do we have so little insight into how the students are feeling about the current state of the football team? Is there an unwritten rule about using current students as unnamed sources? What happens to the journalistic relationships formed during the recruiting process? That is from at Out of the Gates. I can answer this one in a relatively straightforward fashion, because I did do some recruiting reporting at some point. You're never going to see an on-the-record quote from a current athlete that wasn't set up by the athletic department. That's how it works. If you want to keep your credential, you are not going to set up an interview with a player that is on the team, because you're circumventing the media relations department, which is there for a reason. They do not want these students who are students, and I will use students in this case, inundated with off the record or like unofficial, uncredentialed interview requests or questions from random people that they feel obligated to answer. So that, I mean, there's a reason that this system is set up. There are relationships that are formed during the recruiting process that certainly continue through the time when a player is on the team. In my experience, you generally hear from players when players want to reach out to you and not the other way around. You're not trying to infringe on their time. And this is stuff that happens off the record and is not something that is going to be used in a forum that you're really going to be able to pick up on, because it's circumventing what how the athletic department wants these things to be run. At the same time, sometimes the athletes want certain messages to get out there and don't want to go through official channels to do so, and that is one way to do it. So I don't think it's a bad system the way it's set up right now, but it does mean that at the moment, you know, we're not going to be getting on the record quotes from the players. I don't know what they'd really have to say anyway. But you
We
know,
suck and we don't like sucking.
yeah, like and you know, Jim Harbaugh is our coach, so hooray, Jim Harbaugh, because he controls the depth chart that I'm on. Like it's hard for players to really go rogue because, you know, there are going to be consequences to that, and also it generally would not be that difficult to pinpoint if a player was an off the record source. You'd probably at least be able to narrow it down to which side of the ball or the position group. So you're just not going to get a lot of that. And I think that's fine right now because whether on or off the record, I don't think you're going to get a ton of insight into things that you don't necessarily get from like the number of transfers that are happening. So with that, we're going to take another break and look at the potential transfer targets for this team for next year. Question is from at Jacobius Nobilius, who has my favorite display name on Twitter, JD Vance Guaraldi Trio. That is exceptionally strong.
It's pretty good.
He asked, top transfer targets, whether Harbaugh stays or there's a new coach, Matt Campbell soon come. That was his words, not mine. I want to make that very clear. There's going to be some positional holes to fill. Who do you think can be a solution at those spots? I believe Dan and Connor have poked around a few names. Dan, we can start with you.
Yeah, so I know number one, I think this the transfer market has never been this strong. So the first name I'll throw out there is Antonio Shelton from Penn State. I believe he was a top 100 recruit. I think he's going to be a junior. And I think he had 3.5 sacks this year. And, you know, Penn State's defense was still pretty good, even though, you know, they overall weren't a very good team. And, you know, I mean, look, he's a defensive tackle that had reasonable production and, you know, was a high-level recruit. I mean, you know, that's that to me, that's like best-case scenario for a you know, for a transfer defensive tackle. Connor, do you have any thoughts on him or do you have any other names?
Yeah, I mean, Shelton should be someone Michigan goes after hard. If there's any reason to be like pessimistic there, it's just that, you know, transferring within your same division of your same conference may not be something guys always want to do, but like he's top of my list. Mohamed Diallo from Western Michigan, who also has a teammate who was an All-American and Treshawn Hayward, who we would love to see at linebacker. But he was a pretty beastly interior lineman as well. You know, he's obviously in the same state. It's often fairly easy for Michigan to get those guys. That's probably one of the easier ones to get. There's a couple guys from Clemson, Jordan Williams and Niles Pinckney, who were both in the portal. And look, I know that they're transferring because they're not playing as much at Clemson as they might like. That's the most likely reason anyway. But like, Clemson has pretty good defensive linemen, and if there's a couple Clemson guys in the transfer portal, if Michigan had a shot to get all four of these guys, I would say get all four of them, like free up the scholarships.
Those two Clemson guys were also mentioned by Bryce Marich in a report on the Michigan Insider, I believe today. Antonio Shelton mentioned in there Diallo as well. and two players who have committed to other schools, unfortunately, already. That's kind of an issue for Michigan, is it's hard to get people to commit to your team when they don't know who's going to coach it. So that this list could be affected. One name that caught my eye as I was scrolling through is at tight end. If Michigan wants to beef up their ranks a little bit there after kind of a disappointing year at the position. I know they've got some young guys coming up, but if you want an immediately eligible senior, Jacob Mathis out of South Florida has put his name in there. He was a four-star recruit who committed to Ole Miss initially before going to USF, and was I think he picked Ole Miss directly over Michigan. I think Michigan finished second in that recruitment, so he's familiar with the school. And USF is enough of a mess of a program that I'm not going to ding him for relatively limited production there. So he might be an interesting guy to bring in just in terms of adding extra bodies. I think you guys have covered the DT position pretty well, and that linebacker position has been covered. Are there any cornerbacks or safeties that have jumped out to anybody as I totally act like I've scrolled through this before? Yeah, like the transfer portal lists, it's also tough because the transfer portal lists a ton of guys, and it's very difficult to tell who's going to have immediate eligibility because there will be a lot of, I assume, a lot of waivers granted.
So I've got one, Isaiah Rutherford, who was a top 250 recruit who went to Notre Dame in the class of 2019. The reason I specifically mention him is not only because he was a four-star cornerback, but also I think Giles Jackson quote tweeted his announcement post for leaving Notre Dame and said, hit my phone. So I'm this is me trying to read, I'm getting old now, so I can't Giles Jackson is young and hip, so I won't try to pretend that I know what that means. But it seems like
Giles Jackson appears to want him here is the upshot.
Yeah, exactly. And Giles Jackson is the best recruiter on the team right now. So
and it looks like they're both from California, so hey, maybe that would be great. I mean, God bless Giles Jackson. He has done so much recruiting for this program in the past 2 years. I mean, he really has.
Yeah, no, Xavier Worthy is a Giles Jackson joint, as it were. God bless you, Giles.
Yeah, so I think there's one other name that jumped out to me at safety, Antoine Richardson, who was a one-time Michigan commit who ended up at Maryland. Had some injury issues there, did start there for a while, and I think has moved between cornerback and safety. He already has immediate eligibility, and at least at points in his career was outplaying his three-star rating. So he could be a guy that, has some familiarity. Again, you run into the, transferring inside your division issue, but apparently that wasn't a holdup for Zach Carpenter, who ended up at Indiana, and notably not Cincinnati. So we'll see. I mean, I think, we're probably not close to done seeing players enter the portal either. This is something that you see happen both immediately after the season and also during spring practice as it becomes more clear where players are on the depth chart. Who knows what we're going to get in terms of spring practices this year. That might be a whole another thing, but at least if we're talking about a semi-normal process, hopefully Michigan having to wait out this whole coaching thing won't mean they also miss out on a number of targets.
Oh, and to say, throw out one more name that I'm stealing from MGO Please. Board, which was the Notre Dame defensive end Ovi Ogufo, who has 5 sacks his Notre Dame career, and he's from Farmington. And he grew up a Michigan fan, has a bunch of Michigan ties. We need people at every defensive position, honestly. So, I mean, if he's interested, I'd give him a strong look, too.
Yes, bring him home. With that, we're going to take one final break here, and then I'm mostly going to talk to myself about basketball. When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com. Connor has tapped out on the basketball conversation and is probably off to write his literary newsletter that he forgot to mention at the top of the show, but will be linked in the show notes. So, you know, make sure to keep an eye out for that. And Connor, be better about self-promotion. our first basketball question comes from at Colin TJ. Will Michigan finish with the best two-point field goal percentage allowed in the conference? And if not, where will they end up and who will beat them out? I didn't bother to look up who would beat them out because I do think Michigan is going to finish with the best two-point field goal percentage in the conference. I guess if a team does have a chance of coming close, it's probably Wisconsin, just because they have two centers, are overall quite strong. But Michigan is over 4 percentage points clear of second place in the conference in two-point percentage defense right now. That is Minnesota, who has an imposing 7-foot center in Liam Robbins. Michigan also has one of those in Hunter Dickinson. They've got more size and secondary shot blocking ability. Michigan is first in the conference in block rate. All the peripherals and the eyeball test to me point towards Michigan maintaining this really remarkable defense inside the arc and just overall defensive quality. Dan, do you have any insight you want to add on that one?
No, not really. I mean, I think you hit it all. I mean, the amount of just like length that Michigan has makes any sort of foray into the paint like just very, very unlikely to result in like, you know, an easy bucket in any way. So yeah, I mean, I would say the only thing I have to add there is that I think that, you know, as a relatively new, like, avid basketball fan, that they shouldn't be called field goals, because no one calls them that in real life, and that's a football term, and we all know, like, they should be called shots or baskets or whatever. It's stupid that they're technically called field goals.
I'm surprised you did not advocate for bucket. but I'm going to say that was showing good restraint. But, yeah, I mean, Michigan's length across the board that you mentioned, you know, we are just coming off a game where Franz Wagner has 5 blocked shots. Everyone in the starting lineup except Mike Smith is a legitimate shot blocking threat that somehow includes Eli Brooks. who is also a Thunder dunk threat, which is pretty fantastic. And obviously, Chandi Brown coming off the bench is a guy who can block some shots, especially in transition or as a help guy, or even also on the ball, actually. And I shouldn't limit him. He's a very versatile defender. So yeah, I'm sticking to my guns and saying Michigan's gonna keep it up, and I think we've got a consensus here. The next question is from I am Stefan Zonia, who also has one specifically for Dan. So the first question is: are we the best team in the conference, and why is the answer obviously yes? And with the bonus question specifically for Dan, who is more of a trademark problem between Hunter Dickinson and Franz? I want Dan to answer that question first.
So here's the thing. I always think of problem and bucket as two different things. You can be a bucket, but not necessarily a problem. And you can be a problem without necessarily being a bucket. Franz is definitely more of the problem. Because he's so long, and you know, he's a shooter. Like, he's just, in my mind, he is such a matchup problem, and he's a problem, you know, seeing him in the paint. And like, I think that he truly embodies what it means to be a problem. Dickinson is more the bucket. He's like, you get the ball to him and it's like definitely going in. Like, I feel incredibly secure when he gets the ball in the post. So just to clear things up, Dickinson is the bucket, Franz is the problem.
All right. It is an important distinction to have, and that is why we have you on as our basketball correspondent.
You're not going to get that everywhere.
To answer the initial question, is Michigan the best team in the conference, and also why is the answer obviously yes? I don't feel like I'm being a homer when I think that Michigan, just in terms of how well they match up across the board, especially if they can tick their turnovers down a little bit. I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that to the degree that we'd like to see, but I do think it'll come a little bit down from literally last place in the Big Ten. This is still a conference that has Indiana and Nebraska, so I have hopes there that won't prove. And if that happens, I do think Michigan is the team that's most likely to come out on top of the conference right now. It's easy to say that when they're the only team without a loss, but that does mean something when you haven't lost any of your potential leverage yet. Michigan does get a nice kind of ramp up into the true meat of their schedule. And I like the way they match up with most every team other than Iowa of the contenders. And I think, just because while I think Michigan can score a ton of points on Iowa, that the same potentially can happen on the other end. It's just Iowa can go off for a lot at any moment. But Iowa also has a poor defense that allows other teams to go off at any moment, and I think that that's going to lead to some losses they shouldn't take. It already has. And, you know, Illinois has steadied themselves, but also leans pretty hard on their two stars, whereas Michigan is a bit more balanced. I just think the combination of balance, offense, and defense that Michigan is showing, especially if this Wagner breakout keeps up, does position them to be the best team in the conference. That is my long-winded answer to that question.
Yeah, and I also think, I mean, the ramp-up you mentioned is so important. I think that Michigan could, like, go on a pretty crazy run up until, like, the last couple weeks of the conference season while the Big Ten sort of cannibalizes itself. And by then, it's like, yeah, Michigan will probably take some L's in the last part of their schedule, but it might be just enough that, like, they're on such a roll and they're gelling so much that, like, they have enough momentum to just, you know, hold out and win the conference outright in the regular season.
Yeah, to that point, the number of coin flips and the nature of averages means that KenPom projects Michigan to go 13-7. But in terms of individual game projections, Michigan is not projected to lose a game until Valentine's Day at Wisconsin.
And Michigan's been really good about, like, pretty much destroying every team that they should beat. You know, Michigan's been a good team at covering the spread this year, basically every game since Oakland.
Yeah, the Penn State game was the only one that was kind of a bit of a hiccup where it felt closer than you wanted, unless you want to count the first half when Maryland was just making everything they threw up, regardless of shot quality. So, yeah, there's a lot to be said for that. This question I might have accidentally partially answered beforehand, but from at Mike Coop Forster, what Big Ten team do you think will give Michigan the most trouble? I'm guessing Illinois because they have a better chance of stopping Dickinson than Iowa. Dan, I'll let you start since I already partially gave away my answer.
I'm weirdly not. Look, so this is my, like, I'm very much a dumb guy Michigan basketball fan. And my dumb guy take is that I'm not that impressed by Illinois. I can't really tell you why. I just am not. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that's a really stupid thing to say. But I think it'll be Iowa because I think that'll be like a sort of a welcome to the Big Ten moment for Hunter Dickinson. Not that he'll have a bad game, but I think that Garza can really give him the work, on defense. Garza will score a lot on Hunter Dickinson is what I'm saying. I'll say that it's Iowa, just because I think, like, Iowa can just score so much that, you know, they can really create, like, the kind of track meet that Michigan hasn't really been in. Where it's like Michigan has been going off on a lot of teams and really just blowing them out in the second half. And Iowa can really make that like a full game track meet.
Yeah, I like the way Michigan matches up with Wisconsin, especially now that Franz Wagner apparently is an extremely viable post defender. So you don't have to worry as much about the way Wisconsin can play inside out with both of their bigs a little bit. I agree with you that Illinois scares me a little bit. The good news is Michigan gets both of these teams just once at home and in the latter half of the season. So Dickinson's going to have had plenty of tests, including the one coming up tonight by the time you listen to this, most likely, against Liam Robbins in Minnesota. He'll have played him twice by the time he ends up going against Kofi Coburn and the Fighting Illini. So Dosunmu does give me a little bit of fear because of his size at guard, but Michigan can stick, you know, one of their true guards on Trent Frazier or another off-ball guy and hopefully put Shondi Brown on Dosunmu and shut him down a little bit. Iowa, meanwhile, the combination of Garza and also if Jordan Bohannon's three-point shot is really back, that takes their offense to a different level. That's the team that, just because of their ability to purely outscore Michigan, scares me the most. But I think the most important thing to draw out of this conversation is that Michigan State was not mentioned once.
I've been thinking about this for like the past couple days. It's just like, how many points is Dickinson going to score on MSU? And I know, by the way, I am fully aware that the last time I did how bad is MSU segment, they beat us, and it was the worst.
Different sport. Of my life. This is the good sport.
And I'll never learn my lesson. I will do the same thing next year. But Hunter, like, I mean, how many points is Hunter Dickinson going to score on MSU? They're a bad team, but their weak spot of their already bad team is their post defense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it largely depends on how they decide to play him, because if they just try to go one-on-one on him all game, he could easily put up 30. If they are throwing really hard doubles at him because they know that he can easily put up 30 on, like, 17 shots if they go one-on-one with him, then it might be a thing where he gets a lot of assists and hockey assists. And given the way his luck has gone, like, more of the latter than the former, because he's just consistently passing out of the post to wide open guys. I'm really looking forward to that matchup.
Yeah, me too.
All right, we got one last question from Jeff in NYC. This was by email. When Hunter Dickinson was signed, one of the big benefits seemed to be that he was likely to stay for 3 to 4 years. Does his start this year change that projection? By how much is he a risk to leave this year? Will his athletic limitations and lack of a three-point game keep him here 4 years or somewhere in between? Thanks. I hate this question because I hate where I'm starting to go with my answer, which is that 3 to 4 years is probably more than we're going to get. And at this point, I'd be pretty happy with a second year. Because even if Dickinson, you know, I don't think he's going to be projected as a lottery pick at any point. You know, he hasn't flown up into the first round on draft boards that I've seen, but he is starting to grab the attention of people. He is a big-time player on a team that is probably going to make a pretty strong run here, and he's the centerpiece of it. That is going to catch the attention of NBA scouts, even if he has certain limitations. He just hit two mid-range shots very smoothly in this Northwestern game. He's showing more mobility on defense than we expected, which, you know, obviously expectation was low, but, you know, the NBA has plenty of pure drop centers, including on, you know, starting on some very good teams. So if Dickinson can continue to show his level of skill and also, you know, commitment to the game and improvement in his body and everything, I don't know how much higher he's going to be able to push his stock, especially since he's already 20 years old, as you'll hear on a lot of broadcasts and maybe on certain Michigan State beat writers' Twitter accounts. Kofi Coburn came back and he was older than Dickinson as a freshman last year, so there is certainly some hope in that regard. But that was also something that was up in the air, and I think that's kind of where we're headed with Dickinson, because unless he's, you know, kind of got the Bo Wagner thing going, where Wagner just really loved college and that was kind of what swung his decision for his senior year, I think Dickinson, if he wants to strike at his peak, it might be within the next year or two. And a senior year at this point seems like kind of a pipe dream.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me it's like, what you want to sell Dickinson on for next year is, like, hey, come back, like, get your body in shape, you know, like, for the NBA, like, really, you know, get yoked, Camp Sanderson, all that. And then, like, the best thing that could happen for Michigan as a program is for him to get, like, roasted a little bit by Luka Garza and, like, have to come back to kind of work on his defense. But, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Ace, where it's like, okay, he's already 20, and he could definitely be on an NBA roster right now. And, like, okay, how much is he really going to improve his draft stock by another year of college? So, I don't know. I hope we get one more year.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And I agree that there will definitely be a bit of a, like, you know, the Alonzo Mourning GIF reaction if Garza or Coburn give Dickinson a lot of trouble on defense in the post, just, you know, so there's something for the scouts to think about. Or if he, you know, bricks a couple of those mid-rangers pretty badly, you know, it's wouldn't be the worst thing.
Absolutely.
You know, we're definitely into the extremely good problems segment of the season right now, and specifically with Hunter Dickinson. Where, first of all, he's giving a lot of problems to opposing teams in terms of just completely bending them out of shape. Even when he's not scoring, he is also scoring a lot. And, it might be a little bit of a problem holding this roster together. But the good news is Michigan has the number one class for 2021. 2022. That's cool. And that is it for our podcast today. Thank you to both Dan and Connor for joining me and bearing with me during this basketball segment in Dan's case. It's been good to be back, and we will talk to you again next week, probably. Cue the music.